Greetings, I'm Tricia Cuffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida, your host for New Books in Architecture with a special mini-series in Landscape Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. If you have any ideas for books, please send me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. And today I have award-winning landscape architect Lori Olin. His book is France Sketchbook, published by Aura Editions in 2020. Now, Mr. Olin is a distinguished teacher, author, and one of the most renowned landscape architects practicing today. From vision to realization, he has guided many of Olin's signature projects, which span the history of the studio from the Washington Monument grounds in D.C. to Bryant Park in New York City. His recent project is the AIA award-winning Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Now, Lori studied civil engineering at the University of Alaska and pursued architecture at the University of Washington, where Richard Hagg, fortunately for us, encouraged him to focus on landscape. He is currently practice professor of landscape architecture at the University of Pennsylvania, where he has taught for over 40 years, and is the former chair of the Department of Landscape Architecture at Harvard University. Lori is a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, a fellow of the American Society of Landscape Architects, and the recipient of the 1998 Award in Architecture from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He is also the recipient of the 2012 National Medal of Arts, the highest lifetime achievement award for artists and designers bestowed by the National Endowment for the Arts and the President of the United States. He also holds a 2011 American Society of Landscape Architects Medal, the Society's highest award for a landscape architect. Hi, Lori. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Tricia. It's nice to be here. Thank you.
Now, normally I ask guests, you know, like, what is your motivation for writing this book? But in this case, I'll change it. What was your motivation for drawing this book?
Well, I draw. I love to draw. I've always drawn. And so this book is just full of drawings I've made over the years in a place I'm rather fond of, which is France.
Now, why a France sketchbook and not a French sketchbook?
Well, because if it said French sketchbook, you'd think it would be sketches by French people. So this is me drawing France. It's not French. French is a language, actually. France is a place.
Good point. So how did all of this begin?
Back in 1967, I was living in New York, and I'd never been to Europe. And as a young designer, you know, you want to go see these places that you know are important. And you know, most people in the arts, my age, when you were young, Paris was the center of the art world. It's where Picasso was. And it was the center of the movie world. It's where Brigitte Bardot was. It was the center of philosophy, where Sartre was. Paris was it. It was hot. And so in 1967, as a young architect in New York, I thought, I've got to go to Paris and take a look. So I, back in those days, you could get a 21-day round-trip excursion flight to Europe pretty cheap. And so I dashed off in September and for 3 weeks, and I was just blown away. It was, you know, what I hoped it would be. It was stimulating. And I started, you know, as a person who's drawn all my life, I started drawing immediately in France. Actually, the funny thing was I didn't draw much in Paris. I was so gaga. I ran around looking at everything. But when I went down to Provence for a week, and then I kind of slowed down, and when you slow down, you can draw. So I started to draw. So that's how it began. And then I've come and gone ever since for various reasons. And every time I went, I would take a sketchbook and always make sure I had time to go sit and draw.
You know, I found the first sentence very intriguing. I love to draw. Why do you love drawing, and what does it do for you?
Well, drawing, you know, drawing is an interesting act of the hand and the brain when the eye is in between. The eye, you know, people forget that your eyes aren't separate organs like kidneys or livers or the heart. The eyes are actually part of the brain. They're two. You know, there's these holes in your skull, and a couple of pieces of the brain hang out through those holes, and those are the actually retentive portions, you know, visually stimulated by light, parts of the brain. And so your seeing is actually part of your brain's activity. And so the notion of being able to see and look carefully at things is a way of learning about the world. And so drawing is really about seeing. It's not about wiggling your wrists, you know. It's really about learning to look carefully at things. That's how I felt. And still feel. That's what I tell the students anyway. Hope it's true. It seems true.
How does keeping a sketchbook help you see and help your career?
Well, I think a lot of artists, a lot of designers keep sketchbooks, and they keep them for different reasons. There are a lot of different kinds of drawings in sketchbooks. Some are, in the sketchbooks I keep anyway, some of the drawings are about ideas for projects. You get an idea and you kind of make doodles and you think about it. Some of them are, you see something that you want to remember, so you make a sketch of it carefully. And then some you just do for sheer pleasure or for the fact that it makes you sit and look at something and be there. You know, it's a form of, it's almost an existential thing about being in the world that, to draw, you have to sit still, you know, you have to be motionless, and it takes time, and in the time that you are drawing, you think, and so you're looking at something, and you're thinking about the drawing, but it stimulates other thoughts, and so sketchbooks, I know a lot of designers who have sketchbooks, many of my students do, a lot of painters and sculptors I know have sketchbooks. Most of the great artists that, you know, when you go to museums, they don't show them all the time, but Picasso and, you know, Delacroix and all these people had sketchbooks. And in the sketchbooks are ideas. You put down notes thinking toward the future about things that interest you or appeal to you or you're still trying to puzzle about, you know. So they're full of different things. You know, that's why the sketches are quite different. Some of them are one way, some of them are another way, you know.
This book, I mean, it's just beautiful. And I just want to let our listening audience know that you've used pen and ink and pencil and watercolor. How did you choose these mediums? What was your process?
The process for selecting for the book was to try and show a variety and pick things that would appeal to people that are visually attractive or interesting. But the different choice of medium, sometimes it's an accident of the day. You're out somewhere and you only have a fountain pen with you. Other times you think, well, it's an afternoon, I could go out, it's a nice day, I think I'll take my watercolors with me. You know, and I have a very small little box of watercolors that fits in your pocket. You know, then it has a little water bottle in it and a little cakes of colors and a tiny brush and stuff. And so, you know, there's some days you think, well, I have the time and the luxury to do a watercolor. Or there's other days when you just happen to have a pencil, that's all you've got. Or you think, well, this one is soft and smudgy. But the other thing is that in sketchbooks, quite often one doesn't put too much pencil because it smears, or the pages rub together, whereas with the ink or the watercolor, it tends to be more permanent. It doesn't smudge or smear as badly. So it's partly based on the medium and how expressive it is for the thing you're representing, but it's also partly based on time or convenience or just accident.
Yes, yeah, it shows me everywhere. You went on all these trips. Now, I want to give you a chance to talk about Pablo. He did the design for this book.
Yeah, Pablo Mandel is a designer of books. He lives in Buenos Aires, and he's done a lot of books for other people. He recently did a catalog raisonné of Cesar Pelli's work. He's done books for Peter Boland. He just designed a lot of books for Oro, the publisher that did this book and my last book, Be Seated. And Pablo, one of the things about Pablo is he's a visual artist himself. And so when he designs a book, it usually turns out to be a pretty handsome piece of work in its own. He's just this great guy to collaborate with, that's all. He's also a good musician, by the way. Yeah, you know, he plays the guitar, and he's an artist also, but his medium is usually books, which I find interesting.
You mentioned many famous artists in this book. I mean, you know, Delacroix, we all know, is amazing, and I've been to the Rodin Museum, actually, in Paris too, and I loved it. What did you learn from these masters when you copied and drew their artwork?
Well, one of the things, in the sketchbook, there are sketches I've made of works of other artists, you're right, in France, and Brancusi and Rodin and Delacroix. There are other artists that didn't make it into this book that I'm interested in that I looked at, but what happens is when a person like myself, other designers and artists go out, we're interested in the work that other people do and how they do it. We're interested in how they see. And Delacroix was, you know, sort of at that odd transition between romanticism and realism. He was a great romantic in some ways. But he was facile. Oh my God, he could draw like an angel. And some of his best work was when he went to North Africa. And he was absolutely fascinated by the horses and Arabs and the world of the interiors in Tangier and places like that. And one of his greatest paintings is in the Louvre. It's the, you know, the demoiselle in these four women in a room, and it's an incredible painting. But I've always liked his sketchbooks, and so one of the things I did when I was in Paris was I went to his house, and like Cézanne and others, he managed, by the time he was finally very successful, he built the studio of his dreams. Of course, by that point, he'd done most of his best work. You do your best work usually when you're poor, and when you finally make it, you have this great facility, but you're kind of getting tired, you know. So quite interesting, but it was, so, you know, there are people whose work interests you, and you try to, and so by looking at it and drawing it, it makes you, when you, to draw, to make sketches of things that you admire, it makes you have to see them on how they're made, you know, that's what I think.
You know, part of my assignments in my painting class was to, we do master studies, we copy master artworks. And at the end, our last assignment is to do a self-portrait. And it's so funny how what we learn, you know, translates into our drawings and paintings, et cetera. Did you find that in your drawings as well?
Well, what happens is when you're drawing, you know, you never know what's going to happen. The drawings have a life of their own, and they can go off in funny directions that you didn't anticipate. But you do find yourself composing on the page as well without realizing that you really are trying to make a good page as well as a good drawing. And sometimes the accuracy or the verisimilitude becomes less of an issue. It's interesting how that happens. You can do self-portraits that turn out to be really, other people think they don't look like you at all, but you don't care. It's a good drawing. You say, well, I don't care. It's a good drawing. But in this case, I would say that I ask students to do copies of, go find somebody they like and do a couple of copies of it, just so they see what it, how it works, the thing they like. And I said, you know, don't worry, you're not going to end up imitating somebody. You'll always be yourself. You can usually tell the student's drawings without them signing them who did which, because their personality comes through whether they mean to or not. You know.
Yes, yeah. It's funny how a little bit of yourself ends up in your drawings too, doesn't it?
Right, absolutely.
So now let's take a little trip through the book to Provence and Arles. And I also want to mention, I enjoyed reading your essays in this book too. I mean, it's not just about drawing.
Well, I do like to write, and I do make notes in the books. And so this book has transcriptions of some of the notes, plus little introductions I did so people know what, where I was and what was going on, or a little about the region if they hadn't spent time there. Yeah, Provence is really pretty special. I mean, the Romans loved it. The French love it. We love it. It's a beautiful landscape and a beautiful climate. And I learned a lot in Provence, not only about history, but about food, about wine, about how to live better. You know, it's that old joke about, you know, living well is the best revenge. It's sort of true. And Provence is beguiling because of the light, the quality of the light, and it's usually, I mean, it does get quite hot at some points in the summer, but in the spring and autumn, and it's just heartbreakingly beautiful. And, you know, when I went there, I had thought that, like many people, well, Van Gogh is a wonderful painter, but gee, it's a little exaggerated and, you know, it's over idiosyncratic and personal. But when I got there, I took this bicycle and we went riding out of Arles down a road that Van Gogh had walked down and done some painting down toward Daudetville and on the road to Tarascon. And lo and behold, I realized actually he saw it better than anyone ever has before or after, that it was, his paintings are so correct about the quality of the light and the shimmer and the feeling of that place. And so it's just one of those, you got to be there sort of things. And so I found Provence as inspiring as many other artists have, you know, Cézanne, et cetera.
Yeah, I was only there a few days and it was just so cool. I mean, what was even neat and amazing is there were signs that marked the places where he painted this painting or that one. And what a great feeling to be at that spot to see that perspective.
Yeah, I was in Cannes one time. I was working on a project for a client and I was walking along this upper road in Cannes, and suddenly there's a little plaque and it said, and this is where Bonnard painted this view out over the bay. And I looked out and I thought, oh my God, it's right. This is where he was. He stood right here. I'm there. And that happens to you in Provence. You'll be going along and suddenly, oh yeah, this is where Matisse did that view of the Promenade d'Anglais. Doesn't look quite the same today, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's an insight into the artistic mind.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It helps you see what they saw by going to where they went. And in a way, that's kind of what some of the drawings are about, is to help me see what's really there, you know?
Now let's go to Haute Provence. I think, did I say that right? Where is that at?
Oh, it's the upper part. It's above Aix-en-Provence. It's where the Luberon is, and it goes east toward the Alps, and it goes over to the Durance River, and it's an area that is the English discovered it, of course, like they discover many things. But one of the things is that it's an area that is less full of tourists in some way. It's sleepier, more remote than the area closer to the Mediterranean. So Haute-Provence, that's where the lavender all comes from, that makes all the soaps and everything, you know, fragrances that everybody has. And it's just below the Alps. It's quite beautiful. And we discovered a little village there called Dauphin. We were the only non-French people in the whole village, it's quite special. And we went for these walks, and one would keep finding Roman ruins and old ancient farms and all sorts of things like that. It's very beautiful and still not overrun.
Yeah, I have the book open there. What is one of your favorite drawings from there and why?
What are my favorites? Well, say the roof terrace where we stayed in Dauphin, where we would have dinner every night and watch the stars, and where the swifts and the swallows would be flying all around us because of the color. It's just the watercolor that I did in the book, it's actually the sun is not shining on the wall, is in shade, and it is so bright. It is this orange color that comes from the ochre of the earth there in the alpeel, and there's this kind of blue green color, this teal color that they paint on the window frames, and this chair that is this kind of aqua green. The colors there are just knock you out. I mean, that's a good one, I would say. Or maybe the one inside where I do the two bags of pigment that it's just like, oh my God, you know, look at the colors. And it's the pigment that they mix into the wash that they put on the stucco on the outside of the building. When they do the plastering, they mix this color in, and it's the ground pigment. And it's just remarkable, the colors.
Well, let me ask you something. How do you go about setting up challenges for yourself to make you to bring your art to another level? You know, what do you do to learn more and draw better?
You think, well, I've done a drawing of this, but what would you do that might be more revealing or more difficult? Or maybe stretch yourself and try something that you haven't done. Every now and then I would say, well, I haven't really looked at the grapes carefully. So I go sit in the vineyard, right, you know, take a little, you know, a little folding stool and go sit right next to a grapevine. I thought, well, you know, we all drink wine and we all talk about the vineyards and we all drive around, but who's actually gone and sat with the grapes and stared at them and looked really closely? So I would go do that, you know, or you would think, what would happen if I did a drawing where I had something really close that was in focus, and then there was this thing way far away that I'm seeing? Because when your eye shifts, you see, the interesting thing is the eye can shift in ways that you can't really do with a camera. But in a drawing, you could put different things in focus in different places. And so sometimes I'd say, I wonder, I should try a drawing that's the way the eye moves along, and start maybe on the left side of the page and have the drawing wander along the way the eye would follow and track things, and have the drawing just be that. You know, so you make up, artists make up problems for themselves and try to solve them.
Yeah, it's all interrelated.
It's design is an aspect of art, and art is it's all the same stuff in a way, you know?
Yeah, it's the right brain, yeah, that nonverbal expression, I think.
It is, and but it's also related to other things, like in music, the idea of rhythm, the idea of contrast, the idea of harmony. All arts really deal with many of the same problems. It just comes out in different forms and in different ways, and they're sort of non-translatable. It's like when someone asked, Beethoven played this sonata one evening in a room with a bunch of people in Vienna, and at the end of it, this woman said the equivalent, "Oh, Mr. Beethoven, that's so wonderful. What does it mean?" He said, "What does it mean? What does it mean?" He turned around, played the whole thing all over again, and turned around and said, "That's what it means." That's sort of what about drawings and paintings and music, is that they are an expression of something that can't be expressed some other way, you know?
Yeah, it's a full layout, page 446. It's a pen drawing. Please tell me more about it.
Right. So the drawings, some of them are just like a few notes, and some of them are like little mini essays. And you have to figure out, should I spend a lot of time? You'd like people to spend as much time looking at a drawing as they spend reading a page sometimes. And most people don't do that. They don't know that it's all there to read, you know, like
yeah,
that.
You know, sometimes this modern era, you know, we just flip through things too fast. This one looks like it took a while. It's very beautiful.
Yeah, it's an ink drawing of a wall fountain, and then a door, and then there's a ramp going up a hill, and a couple of pigeons coming down a wall, and then the drawing goes off to the right and down a street, and it looks like it's going to turn a corner and disappear behind some buildings. Yeah, it's an interesting drawing, actually.
Yeah, it's a whole story right there.
Yeah, it may have been almost an hour. I was just sitting there. It's below the place that we had rented for that couple of weeks. And it was a nice place to sit because there was this fountain that is on the left of the drawing. There's a watercolor of that fountain somewhere on the previous page. It's this kind of dragon-like thing that people would come there and fill their jugs with it, and kids would play in it, and the birds would drink it, and motorists would stop and up their canteens and stuff. It was just below the house, and I thought, oh, this is really interesting, the way a ramp goes up, you know, the street goes up, the street goes down, the street goes around the corner, the buildings are kind of blank with these small windows, which you find in the Mediterranean because of the heat and the glare. And so I just thought, oh, this isn't very expressive. But then there's all this vegetation as well. So I thought, well, it's interesting, the combination of these blank stucco plaster walls, these deep shadows from the tile, and then these plants that are so sharp in this bright sunlight. And so figuring out how to draw those different things so that you get those, that sensation of the differences and the clarity and the contrast was something that appealed to me. And the left side of the drawing is very dense and the right side of the drawing is very open. You know, this is an example of what I'm talking about how reading a drawing and looking at the drawing and thinking about a drawing the way one does with the text.
Yeah, you have a lamp with some books on a table. Yeah, again, it's another story. And then your gaze out through the window.
Right. And many of the drawings in the book are like that because I have that sort of mind where things intrigue me. And when you sit still long enough, you know, you will begin to see things and you begin to think about them. And you do end up, you know, composing the book in different, your sketchbook. For instance, if you go to page, I just opened it to 82, Tricia, I'm in a hotel room in Paris, and I was sort of dumbstruck by these curtains that had these red flowers on them, and then the view out the window past a grill, and then there's the lampshades and stuff. And so this alternating contrast of these bright things with these plain, quiet walls, it's one of those, as the eye moves across the room, I wanted the drawing to move across the page, you know? Right, yeah. And it's interesting, I did some drawing. You always do drawing, you know, when you're sitting, or you can draw standing up, but then you can't have a very big sketchbook, or it's hard to hold up. But part of the thing someone asked me about, well, gee, there's a lot of drawings at cafes and bars. I said, well, they're designed to sit in and to be leisurely and to spend time, which is what drawings require. And that's why there's a bunch of drawings from parks, too, because they're also meant for you to linger in and sit and be comfortable. And they're for socializing, you know?
Yeah, Paris is more for socializing. How did you like that over there? How is it different from the United States?
Well, I enjoyed part of the public life there greatly, and I found it very inspirational. I've tried to bring some of that quality home and in the work I do for people here. Some of the work I've done in America has been, you know, parks and plazas and that sort of thing. And I've always insisted they have, you know, cafes and bathrooms and nice places to sit and be well made, because it's something I admired so much and enjoyed so much there. So in a way, I, you know, there's nothing in the sketchbooks I ever imitated except the concepts and the ideas that I was learning about while doing the drawings, you know?
I could see that and bring it back home. To travel along here, what about Normandy? How was that different?
Well, Normandy is quite fascinating, and you know, it's toward the Atlantic, and the climate is different, and you know, it's very moist and very lush, and there's all these hedgerows, and you know, a lot of horses, and wine and cheese, and all that sort of stuff. But there are very few big cities in Normandy, almost none. And it's been a battleground for thousands of years of armies coming and going, you know, from the Celts and the Anglo-Saxons right through the Romans and then the English and the French slugging it out for generations there and all kinds of other people. And then World War II, of course, you know, devastated the place. But it still has a lot of medieval and timber, half-timber buildings, which you don't find much anywhere else left in France. The landscape is somehow, it is not as grand. There are no mountains, you know, there's not a lot of mountains. There's a couple of gorges and some good-sized cliffs, of course. But I found it to be calm and quieter, you know. It's where there's a lot of apple orchards. That's where they make Calvados. That's where Brie comes from, and you know, Pont-l'Evêque and some other quite smelly, wonderful cheeses. But visually, it's very different and distinct from, say, the Île-de-France, from the center of France, from the south, or from the mountains of the Continental Divide near Le Puy and in that area. It's in the Auvergne. It has its own character, and I haven't spent enough time there to do enough drawings. There's a handful of drawings here, but most people know Normandy because they know the coast, not just because of World War II either, you know. It's where Coco Chanel had her first shop, as a matter of fact. In Deauville, and you can go see where it was. It's a tiny little thing. It's about 14 feet wide. It's just like talk about a boutique. It really is a boutique. Then it's where Eric Satie was born and raised. There's some interesting towns there. Probably, Bayeux, of course, where the great tapestry is, and that's worth going to see. There's only one little doodle. It's exhibited almost in the dark because they don't want it to fade, and curators really would rather you not see the drawing at all. They'd rather keep it in the dark totally, I think. But anyway, but it seems like it's a mile long. It's incredible. And one of the things was, I only did one or two doodles of it, but it was like this great long narrative comic strip of the story of, William the Conqueror and they're building the boats and leaving and going to England and, winning and all that sort of thing. It's quite wonderful. Normandy is special, partly for how green it is because all the moisture coming in off the Atlantic constantly, year round. It's very beautiful.
Now let's turn to page, let me flip here, 158. It looks like you took some notes about some plants. So where and what is this drawing?
Oh, if you know where you are, this is Monet's garden, and this is Giverny. And we went there, obviously, to go see the famous lily pond, but also, where he painted all those fabulous paintings. His studio is there. And they have a few things in the studio. Most of his paintings, of course, are all in the great museums around the world. But my wife, who is a landscape architect and knows plants better than I ever will, she and I spent a lot of, 2 days there just staring at the plants and looking at what was the combinations of things. And so that's a list of plants that were in the upper garden. Monet made a very interesting garden. There was a road and a railroad. And so he had the upper place where he built the garden is where all the roses and there's espalier plants and there's gravel paths and that sort of thing, herbaceous beds. And it's quite wonderful. And he did paintings up there too, next to the house. But then he managed to get a piece of land across the road down by a creek, a river. They call it a river. It's a big creek to us here in America. But he diverted water from it into one end, built this pond with the famous bridge, and then let the water go back into the river. And so the water flows through, so it's very clean and aerated and all that. It doesn't stagnate. And that's where the lower garden, where the water garden is. And so we spent 2 days there. And of course, you want to get there early before the buses from Paris arrive. And then when they all arrive and they kind of jam the place with tourists from all over the world, then you want to go have lunch. And then you want to come back sort of late after they're all having to leave and go to the buses and stay until the place closes when it gets really quiet and empty and you can see all the plants by yourself. So there are these things you learn. This isn't really a travel book, but I guess in the area of the pandemic when none of us can go anywhere, it is a travel book.
Yes, yeah, I'm enjoying my little travel time here in France. So let's keep the travel train moving along here. Where is Aquitaine?
Yeah, you are. It's Bordeaux, really. This is the area on the Atlantic coast, just above Spain, where a lot of the wines that everybody is familiar with, like the Cabernets and the Merlots, and some of those wines that Entre deux Mers is an area that's between two rivers. It's full of wine, but many of the great vineyards, I mean, there are a lot of great vineyards all over France, like in Burgundy and other places, but which I have spent no time in. But this area, again, it's coastal, and but it has a different sunnier climate than Normandy. But this is also on the edge of the Auvergne, the Dordogne, rather. And the Dordogne is where all the caves are with the cave art. And the cave, you know, is where they keep wine, right? Keep it cool. The French have been using caves for years for one thing or another. And so my family, my wife and her sisters and their families and a bunch of us all went there one summer and camped out in part of a chateau. And it was, people that were supporting the chateau by having renters in some of the outbuildings. And it was quite wonderful because I spent days just wandering around on foot among the vineyards, poking in and out and drawing and looking at the place. And it's, a very different landscape from, say, Normandy, further up the coast, more open, rolling, with these river valleys that are, where the early men and women were hunting the mastodons and mammoths and all that sort of thing. And so it's a fascinating place. People have been there forever, it seems. And again, there's Bordeaux, is a great and important and interesting city, quite beautiful in its way. When we were there, it was one of the hottest years in history, and so everybody was like gasping, but it was still great. I loved it.
Yeah, it looks like you painted a very detailed drawing here. You're looking out a window.
D6. I'm finding it. Yeah, probably am. Hang on. Oh yeah, I'm in a bedroom. Yeah, it's called the Tuileries. This bedroom, named for a place you're fond of in Paris. Yeah, what that is, I'm looking out at, the French, this is an 18th century room. And so they're very high ceilings with these beautiful, that's what we would call French doors. There they are, French doors going out onto the terrace. And there's a elegant chair, a 17th century chair. But what you see is this oval mirror, and there's a painting of a French naval officer reflected in the mirror that was hanging on the wall. And if you recall the film Master and Commander, the great thing about the battle that took place the First World War between the French and the English went on every continent and in every ocean. But the French had really quite a remarkable navy, and most of it, the ships are all built along this area. There's a town that has a great rope walk and that sort of thing nearby that we went to visit. So there is still this sense of the sea and its relationship to the rest of the world that one finds in Aquitaine, which I found interesting.
Yeah, a little bit of the interior and the exterior. I know this is a hard question, choosing your favorite drawing or painting. I want you to... What would you like the audience to know in this book? What's the first page you would like for them to flip to?
Oh, you mean about this one we're talking about, this interior? Because I think this drawing shows a series of different things all in one image that are thought-provoking. One is the quality of the architecture, the height of the proportions of the room and how unique that is in our current experience, the notion of the history that we tend to forget about, the fact that there was this international war waged between these two great naval cultures, these marine cultures, and then the colors, the rich, these beautiful, rich, warm colors. So there's all different sorts of things going on in this picture. There's history, there's architecture, there's visual composition, there's color. So that's all those things were things that were occurring to me while I was making it that I'm sharing.
Okay, yeah, I just flipped to page 113. Yeah, the panorama and the cliff above it.
Page 114, which is a watercolor looking into an old mill compound that was once owned by the Popes of Avignon, where we rented a piece of a mill one summer by a stream in the middle of this giant vineyard a few miles from Avignon. And here you can see layers of history. You see abandoned things. You see modern road signs. You see a roller dumpster for the garbage man. You see all sorts of things, but you also see the sunlight of Provence. You see the kind of heat that you can almost hear the cicadas in this. So that's when I would send people to.
Oh yeah, I really love this book. You know, the many paintings and drawings here tell little stories. I didn't realize that. Yeah, from left to right, they do.
Well, that's partly because I like these horizontal sketchbooks. I found these sketchbooks in Paris many years ago. You know, you can get books bound on the long side, which then you hold vertically, which is like most novels that we read and things like that. We call that portrait because, portraits tend to be vertical composition. And then landscapes tend to be horizontal. And so the book that's bound on the narrow end that opens up double, wide, long, it's called landscape format. And I found these sketchbooks that are made that way in Lyon, and I bought them in Paris. And I whenever I'm in Paris, I try to get a bag full of them if I can, because I fill them up. But they lend themselves to drawing landscape considerably, because landscape has such extension. And so one of the things about these sketchbooks, there are in this book that people can buy, there are numerous drawings in the more normal vertically bound books, but predominantly the drawings tend to be horizontal. And that's because of turning your head and looking at the landscape and moving around and your eye moving. And I like that a lot. It works well for depicting the things that have interested me.
That's a beautiful way to showcase what you did. Yeah, I like how you utilize the whole page.
Well, that's Pablo's genius. You know, Pablo has a way of trying to help you see the drawings better. So he'll show you the whole double page, and then he'll take you into a piece of it. His choice of how to look at my drawings to help people, partly to make an attractive book, but also how to help people see them, I thought was quite wonderful. I mean, that's why he and I work so well together. There'd be drawings that I say, why are you doing that? And he said, well, I think this will look good on the page. You'd be right. You know, that is a good example. There's a couple of others, I think, not far from that. There's the one where I'm out in the middle of the field. Page 122, where you can see I'm out in the middle of a vineyard, and there's a farm complex in the distance. And then off in the far distance, you see the kind of purpley mountains that are in a gap. And through that gap, the Rhone River is just outside beyond that gap. Those are the mountains along the Rhone that confine it. And there's a castle up on top. You can just barely see this little thing. That's Saint-Victor-le-Cost. Well, there were castles on those mountains that, you know, would defend the Rhone River or whatever. And so if you look at the whole picture, as in the little vignette there, you see the whole composition. And then Pablo zeroed in to show you the brushwork and the quality of the shadows and the sort of the brush dipping back and forth to make the vineyards. He blew it up so you'd actually really see what I was doing in the drawing. All right. Well, and part of the idea, of course, is this is a book about drawing. It's not really a book about design. It's an art book, and it really is about drawing and the act of drawing and seeing, and then of how that interprets and brings forward a place, you know, particular places, in this case, France. If this book sells moderately well, if it doesn't turn out to be a complete bomb, there is another one coming. And we're going to do Italy next, because I have far many more sketchbooks from Italy, because I spent a lot more time in it. So this is the warm up for the next one.
Oh, and that sounds like a good note to end on. My last question is always, what are you working on now? So what can we expect from Italy?
Well, the next project's going to be, I'm going to start it this autumn and start going through the sketchbooks and sorting out things, but it'll be Italy. And I've been, you know, spent a lot of time in Italy for many years in the north and in Rome, in the south, in Tuscany. And there are hundreds and hundreds of drawings. You're going to have a hard time choosing because, you know, I first went there in 1972 to the American Academy in Rome and lived there for 2 years. And I produced a few drawings in 2 years. And then a few years later, I was nominated and put on the board of the American Academy in Rome, and I was on the board of the American Academy in Rome for 20 years and coming and going and tending to it and helping to rebuild it up on the Janicolo in Rome. And then I got involved in helping with the idea of doing a book about La Foce, which is near Montepulciano, to help preserve it for its owner, Benedetto Arrigo. And, you know, we would take family trips to Venice, and we'd go to Naples, and we'd do other things, you know, spring break, or we'd go there in the summer. I'd go there for the Academy. So I came and went to Italy a lot, and there are a lot of drawings. So it'll be fun. Without Pablo, though, I wouldn't even try it.
Well, every artist needs a collaborator, so.
Yeah, he's great, yeah.
I'll have to go out and buy the France sketchbook so we can have that Italy book next.
Yep, but it'll be probably 2 years before it exists, so you may as well digest this one well before I get that one out.
Again, you know, thank you so much for being here today, Lori. It's been a pleasure. And to let our audience know, this book is France Sketchbook, published by Oro Editions in 2020 by landscape architect Lori Olin. And I'm Tricia Keffer from sunny Key Largo, Florida, your host for New Books in Architecture with a special mini-series in landscape architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. If you have any ideas for books, please send me an email at plantspeoplelove@gmail.com. And thank you so much for listening today.